smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
Welcome to Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf, number 3. I'm Fred Green. The goal of this series is to help you golf better with the right gear and to be a smarter consumer when it's time to shop for new golf products. Our previous episode was part one of a conference call about putters. Today, we'll conclude the discussion. Joining me to represent the consumer in this discussion is Kenny Nicholson, technical specialist for Edwin Watts Golf. Welcome, Kenny.
Thanks, Fred. Glad to be here.
We have two guests to discuss putters and the latest in putter technology, and both are legendary in the golf industry. To own a Scotty Cameron putter is akin to pulling up to your favorite golf course in a brand new Porsche. Everyone will notice, and they'll all be jealous. Welcome, Scotty.
Thanks, you guys, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Frank Thomas has made tremendous contributions to club development, both on a business level and as the technical director for the USGA. Frank Thomas is a perfect guest for our podcast because he, too, is passionate about educating consumers about golf technology. And you may be familiar with the Frankly Frog putter, which you can find at franklygolf.com. Welcome, Frank.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Scotty, what should the average golfer expect from his putter?
Well, I would say performance. I think that the consumer in getting fit for a putter, and just the basic fundamentals, length, and I'm a believer on swing weight, so the length does set the swing weight to add feel. So depending on what, from the manufacturer's side, now I think they have to come with more lengths from 33, 34, 35, where 36 and 32 could be a custom order. But I think length, then swing weight, then looks is a first start.
And should the consumer pay attention to materials in regards to the putter construction?
Well, I think that adds a lot of feel, construction does. And not necessarily do you need an insert. I mean, you have fantastic putters without inserts. And I think you can get around making things softer by different metals, different inserts. So it comes down to what he wants to hear, and hearing as part of feeling. But it also depends on what golf ball that you use, because some sound and feel harder and softer than others. So it comes down to what he's actually wanting to hear and wanting to feel and wanting to see.
I agree with that. I think that feel is extremely important. Performance is extremely important. But I think in the design of putters, one needs to recognize that you want to reduce the sources of error that the putter itself or the within the instrument. And we are moving in that direction. We are moving towards higher moments of inertia. By the way, I think you can get too high. I don't think the higher the moment of inertia, the better. I think there's a certain limit on that. But I also think that we need to recognize that the moment of inertia is basically about three different axes. We have what we call an inertia ellipsoid that needs to be recognized and addressed. But the two areas or the two axes of moments of inertia that we should be looking at is one which is from the toe to the heel, as well as from the top to the sole. And that will increase the effective size of the sweet spot in two different directions. Now, original toe-heel weighted putters only give you an increased forgiveness factor or moment of inertia in the toe-heel direction. And so people are now moving towards a higher moment of inertia about the toe-heel axis, not initially at the toe, but the center of gravity is further away from the face. That is a more forgiving putter and one which will assist the golfer in and sort of forgive him of his little mistakes because he's not prepared to practice. Obviously, the more skilled you are, you can choose your putter. As in many of Scotty's putters that are being used on the tour, they're basically toe heel weighted putters, and they are excellent putters. But I think that for the average golfer, he needs to look at the mallet style putter. And certainly also the axis of the shaft is important, not necessarily where it's attached to the club head, but the axis of the shaft.
access to the shaft, Frank, I think for listeners, access meaning where it goes through the head. So if you were to take from the grip an imaginary line down that shaft, now forget about bends, but that access running through the head, the shaft may bend backwards and go into the heel, but the access of the shaft can run through the center of the head, past the center, or short of center, and that is creating a toe hang. Whether it's face balance, where the face points towards the sky, or toe down, I myself very much prefer a quarter hang putter, which helps the putter swing during the path of the stroke.
Right. You know, it depends on your style and depends on what you can control and how you like to sweep the putter, if that's what your style is. And if you can control it. I mean, Bobby Jones and his era and some of the best putters in the world, people putting, I'm saying, not the instrument, used blade putters that were hung almost vertically down. You didn't have a quarter toe down at all, Scotty. So I think we've got to, as you look at irons, you know, some of the best golfers in the world are using blades. Yet, you know, the rest of us, it's not a very good idea to do that. We're just not that good. So we have to go to something a little bit more forgiving that will move us, allow us to get the ball into the air a little more effectively and enjoy the flight of the ball. Hitting a two iron is not much fun if you miss the sweet spot.
No doubt about it. In putter design, Frank's on track. The more we can get that weight back, like the old Futura or the new Detour, getting that weight back, the more forgiving it becomes. But then, for example, on tour, once I get past a certain point of being bizarre or futuristic, then you lose that look, and a lot of guys will try it and know it's more forgiving, but the look does sometimes get in the way, and they go back to something more conventional and more easy to look at.
Yeah, I think you're right, and I think you started off by saying one of the most important things about a putter is the looks. You have to feel comfortable with what it looks like. You can forgive the looks if you find that it's really performing well. It's like when I bought my first VW, the little bug, and it was an ugly little car. And yet it started every time I put the key in it, and it did everything I wanted it to. After a while, I became very fond of it. And the design, I'm still fond of it. It brings back a lot of happy memories. But I think you have to get over that ugly look to begin with, and performance will do that for you. But it is still very important if you want somebody to be attracted to your putter. It's got to be reasonably good-looking and relatively simple, and I think that's what I've tried to do in the putters, and make them as effective as we possibly can, but relatively simple looking and nice and symmetrical, so they get a good feel even before they pick up the putter.
I think the best of both worlds is one, having it perform, two, having it look good, but trying to mix in performance into the look. And once you get that, Frank, it seems funny that a lot of guys on tour always go back to the same kind of look that they are accustomed to, that they had the most success with. And it leaves warm and fuzzy feelings. Certain designs and certain shapes, they always tend to go back to because they had the most success with.
That's a natural phenomenon that we should expect. Anytime you're comfortable with anything and you had confidence in it, you're going to move back to it. It's unfortunate that sometimes your putter doesn't perform very well. And I've suggested to many people who've told me that what you need to do is put it in a closet and make sure it's a dark closet for about a couple of weeks. And when you pull it out again, it's amazing how well it'll perform.
There's no doubt. I believe there's a relationship with your putter. And when you have had success and you always seem to go back to that putter, and there is no doubt a relationship with a special putter.
No question. no question. And but I do think that there's still a little room in putter design. I do think that we've sort of getting close to maxing out on obviously golf balls. They are very little movement left there, and very little movement left in drivers. We've made a significant movement towards helping golfers in their hybrids. But we, you know, and I think that's been a wonderful move. But I think we've still got a little room to go in putters. But probably as important as anything else is allowing golfers to, at least teaching them how to use the putter. We don't practice enough. We don't have the proper instruction. And I think that's as important as the instrument.
Agreed. I agree very much on, you know, one of the misconceptions of the putting stroke to be straight back and straight through, where facts of the lie angle do happen to set the arc of the stroke, but there's so much confusion in the arc versus straight back and straight through. I think the education of understanding what's to happen is very important to getting better.
Right. Yeah, straight back and straight through is okay if the shaft is in the vertical position and it's swinging in a vertical plane, but it's not, and you're not allowed to do that theoretically. I mean, I wrote the rule or helped to modify the rule to make sure that the 10 degree from the vertical was the effective lie angle. But unfortunately, we cannot swing in a vertical plane, and if we did, then straight back and straight through would work. There is a natural arc, and you shouldn't try and fight that.
And we can design putters to help that natural arc be more consistent. And the straight back and straight through, if you're trying to do that, then you're working on a non-natural move. And to get that square back at impact is very difficult, where if you just allow the putter to work, if the putter is designed to work in that proper arc fashion, I think that's a huge subject that needs to be addressed.
No question. I think you mustn't fight yourself, and that just introduces another variable, and if you can't control that variable, it just adds to the inconsistency.
Very much so.
Frank, on the Frankly Frog putter, the images show me that you have center-shafted putters on yours, where, Scotty, a lot of your putters are the heel-shafted. Does one reduce air on mishits more than the other?
Scotty likes that hang down a little bit. I prefer the center axis shafted putter because I think that I want to reduce the errors associated with bringing the club head into the impact zone. I feel that even though I have heel mounted and offsets and all the rest of the axis of the shaft goes through the same spot and the club face near the club face every time, but what I believe is that any time you're trying to move something, there is a resistance to that motion, and if it's eccentric, then you've got a little bit of a force that is trying to resist what nature wants you to do. Now it's a tiny little force, and some of the best putters in the world, who, as I mentioned earlier, were sweep putters, and they like that little toe down balance on a putter, and they can use it very effectively. I feel that unless I'm going to have 15 or 25 different putter styles in my line, I'm going to stick to what I think is the best for the majority of putters at the present time.
How important is the grip?
Well, I think that's very important. I think that's got to be comfortable, and it's got to be something that you really got to work with very hard. A huge grip. I mean, they've done many experiments. Big grips will prevent you from rotating the wrist, certainly in an iron or a wood club or a driver. The bigger grip will not allow you to rotate or rotate your wrist mechanics, the whole wrist mechanics. But so I think you shouldn't get it too small. certainly it doesn't feel comfortable. It's inside of your hand, but you do need to make sure that it feels comfortable and you have control over it. So, you know, don't go, I'm not recommending going to a huge grip, and I'm not recommending going to a really small grip. We've got some, and we got to also recognize something. We got to recognize that the game is about 400 years old, and the best method of developing anything is by trial and error. And if we haven't learned about what the right grip size is yet, then shame on us. And I think it's one thing that you've got to look at, feel comfortable, and you'll be in good shape.
Agreed. Trends that I have seen, Frank, have been grips have gotten larger in years past. I mean, going back 15 years ago, Golf Pride made one called the Pro Only, which was very, very small. And we have seen grip sizes get larger as putter lengths have gotten shorter. And those are just some of the trends I've seen lately in the last 5 years. But one thing, when you do get into a larger grip, that grip gets heavier. And when the grip gets heavier, you have to design heads that are actually heavier on the other side because of counterbalancing. Once a grip gets too heavy, then you lose head weight, and the putter seems to flail instead of be more of a pendulum and have more feel in the head.
Yeah, the thing about balancing of a putter is tough because in no other stroke in the game of golf are your arms and the putter a straight extension. And what we're talking about is another moment of inertia, the moment of inertia about the axis of rotation. And we have looked at moments of inertia of irons and woods and find out that basically if you want to try and match by that, you need to have an axis of rotation, what we call the instant center. And that is about 4 inches above the grip or the of the iron or the driver, because that's where things rotate about during the impact zone. Unfortunately, that axis moves all over the place during the very complex swing that we have. But in a putter, it's a little different. In a putter, because our arms are straight and our arms are part of the overall weight of the system. Now we're talking about a system. So the system, what we should be looking at is the moment of inertia of the system about a certain axis. And as an example, if you wear a wristwatch, it could have not a detrimental effect, but it could have an effect on the overall weight of the system. It's up in the grip area, and I think I use as an example a golf glove. A golf glove is, in essence, part of the grip. Because you're gripping the club so tightly anyway. I mean, so wearing a golf glove, it may as well be in the grip. And if you've ever put a club on a swing weight scale and then added the weight of the glove to the grip, you'll notice that you're decreasing the swing weight by about 5 points. But have you really affected the performance of that club by wearing a glove? And I'm not looking for an answer on that, but I am just asking people to recognize that from a technical point of view, you are adding weight to the axis of rotation, which is really not affecting the overall inertia of the system. And so we need to be a little bit concerned about getting people to want an exact D2 or D3 swing weight, when in actual fact, half of the golfers, even the best golfers, are finding it difficult to detect the difference between three swing weight points. So we just must be a little concerned and don't put too much emphasis on some of the balancing systems that are out there.
I'm being silly here, but I have always wondered, Frank, when Mickelson wears a watch or Bernhard Langer wears a watch, if he was to take off that watch, would he want more weight in the grip because he feels less weight in that area?
You see, I don't believe that he actually does, and that's what that's the point I'm making, is that adding weight to that area is something that is not going to affect the overall dynamics of the club as much as weight on the head. obviously, any time you put weight on the head, it's at a specific distance away from the axis of rotation. And when you're talking about moment of inertia, which is basically the resistance to angular acceleration, or the resistance to twisting in case of a head, but when you're talking about matching a club, you're talking about the resistance about an axis close to the grip. And if you add weight to the grip, it's really not going to affect the dynamics that much.
Well, there is counterbalancing that's going on. There are companies that make brass weights that go under the grip for counterbalancing. And I think there is a feel that people get used to. And whether you have too light of a swing weight, you know, from the tour side, they can feel. Many of golfers have even asked me to get grip weights towards, and this could be more mental than it is a feel, but get their grip weights in a certain area and their head weights in a certain area versus their lengths. So from a putter standpoint, a lot of these pros are picky, and I do believe in balance points and grip weights and head weights, but the overall, what it comes down to is feel. So I think these guys get set into feels, and that's putting has a lot to do with feel.
You know, Scotty, I think that you've been exposed to some of the best people in the world and some of the best players who make a living out of this. And the average golfer trying to do what those guys are doing is like trying to balance your tires to go 250 miles an hour when the engine of the car can't drive it more than 60.
Agreed. And how much of this is just too much to think about, too much mental? When you get over a putt, it's supposed to be a natural move. And if you're thinking about grip weight, head weight, shaft flex, loft issues, lie issues, eyes, ball position, when does it become too much?
Right, it comes too much. I think when you get over the shot, you've got to think of just one thing, you know, aim it and hit it.
I agree.
Wow. You know, we've not even addressed the insert weights, movable weights, face inserts, mill groove. Anybody want to make a comment on that and where it's headed?
You throw out a subject, and I'm sure we have an opinion on it.
That's why you're here.
One question we get a lot, and you guys can touch on, is what's the advantage of groove faces versus milled faces, if there is an advantage? You guys can answer that.
Frank, do you want to start?
I think that that first of all, you've got to have a reasonably flat face. So you've got to mill the face to begin with to be reasonably flat. If it's not flat to start with, then you've got a problem. I do think that there is a trend, and I don't think it's a bad trend, towards a relatively roughened face. I don't think you need a mirror image on the face, a mirror surface on the face of a putter. As far as grooves are concerned, I'm a little skeptical. I haven't seen enough data to show me or convince me that they're going to do anything significant other than actually soften the feel a little bit, if anything. So I'm not a big groove guy. And as far as actual after impact, the effect on the ball, what I like to see is a loft angle of between 3 and 4 degrees, so that we can actually get the ball out of a depression on a normal stroke, get the ball out of the depression that's inevitably going to sit itself into on a green. Even though you don't see it, it's in a little depression. Now, if you don't get the ball out of that depression consistently and you don't have enough loft on the club, what's going to happen is the ball is going to jump out of the little depression and it's going to be inconsistent. And any time that you can get the ball launched consistently each time, it is going to have a little bit of backspin. There's no question about that, and it's going to slide a little bit. But as long as that's done consistently, then we're in reasonably good shape. And I'm not all that convinced that grooves are necessarily going to have a significant effect on performance.
Bear with me on this one, guys, because I do have a thought on this, and Frank is exactly on track. If you look at the PGA Tour and how many wins have been won with a grooved putter this year, I believe There's been zero. Effective loft at impact is very important, and Frank is just right on track. The ball weighs 45 grams, and it does set, whether it's step meter of 8 or 12, it does set in a slight impression. And if you don't have enough loft, the ball goes into that hillside of that impression, and then it gets stuffed. And the lower portion of the ball gets stuck, and the top of the ball comes over, which a lot of these companies try to convince you that that is rolling. Now, hang on. It got stuffed into the side of the cup. It hit. A lot of these companies, though, test this on a 5-foot putt. It's not very dramatic when you hit that and it kind of rolls over. But if you look at 20 and 25 feet, when that ball, for example, 2 degrees aloft, it jumps in the air. But on a 5-foot putt, it really doesn't show much going on, like the ball's rolling. And it makes sense. Sure, I want the ball to roll. But Frank's correct to say we got to get it out of the impression. We have found that 4 degrees loft. Now, I've been doing this 12 years in the studio. Every day when I come to work, it's around putters and performance. And the fact is, your shaft angle from address to impact changes. But a lot of times, you're very consistent in getting it to the same place. If your shaft angle is back 1 degree, you may need more loft. Back, you'd need less loft. If it's forward, you'd need more loft. But the magic number we have found through research is 4 degrees. A lot of these grooved putters have 1 to 2 degrees of loft. So it's not actually the grooves of the face, which we have tested every single one. It's not the grooves of the face. It's actually the effect of loft that's actually making it spin at impact. Now, we could do that by putting 2 degrees loft on the putter. It doesn't have anything to do with the grooves of the face. But what are we trying to do? And Frank is so on track, getting it out of the cup and on the putting surface. But if you have 5 or 6 degrees of loft, the ball now slightly spins backwards. And then it hops. The first 12 inches is the most important to get it online. In fact, through the grooves and C grooves and this groove and that groove, it's the effect of loft and having nothing to do with grooves.
Very good answers.
So.
Very good answers. I'm going to ask this same question to both Scotty and to Frank. And Scotty, this is in regards to the detour. And Frank, this is in regards to Frankly Frog. I would like to know, do you feel that your design on these putters are evolutionary or revolutionary?
Mm. Go ahead, Frank.
I think golf design is evolutionary. I think we take one design and we improve on that and improve on that, etc. There's not much new in the game of golf, and what we're doing is taking science and applying it more effectively. So revolutionary would indicate to me that I've come up with something new that's fantastic and nobody's ever thought of it before, as opposed to the evolution, which is just moving one step at a time towards a result. And I think the Frankly Frog is a putter that has the properties that we would have reached there maybe a little later, but I think it's something that after I have seen and ruled on probably 5,000 putters while I was with the USGA, and I've seen things go round and round and round again, but I feel that to try to decrease or reduce the sources of error as much as possible, I think I've got what I intended to get, and unfortunately, in trying to design something even better, the only thing I could come up with after really racking my brains quite a bit was change the color.
Mm. Wow. Well, I think also we're governed by the USGA on how bizarre, how big, how wild that we can get. And that's where I was talking earlier about I try to stretch those limits. but we are governed, and I believe in this, to govern how bizarre, how big, and we can go here with this. But it's almost like taking something and trying to rework that and trying to pinch every issue to the extreme, but to keep it in the boundaries of the rule from moment of inertia and so on. So you're basically taking a concept and trying to get it to the extreme is what I'm trying to do. And the detour is kind of using conventional looks, but moving in a moment of inertia directions, but also adding feels and benefits for the golfer in hand. So that's just a thought on that.
Yeah, I do think that, Scotty, one of the things we've got to recognize is that when the USGA puts a limit on something, the public seem to believe, and many manufacturers take advantage of this and say, well, the USGA has put a limit on the size of the club or the moment of inertia or whatever the case may be, and we've got to get as close to that as possible because close to the limit must be better. And in some cases, it's not. As an example, and it hasn't worked in that direction, they put a limit on the length of a driver, 48 inches. Now, the Pro Tour average in length is about 45 and a half, maybe just a little, 44 and a half, and which is about the average, and they have access to everything. I think that we are sometimes influenced by a standard or a limitation, which is not necessarily good. I think they're diminishing returns, and I think from a technical point of view, there's you know inertia. If you have too much of a moment of inertia on a putter, you're going to start losing feedback. And there is an important part of the putting stroke and the putting what we call feel, which is feedback that you need, and you need to balance that. You need to find out where that is and where it's most effective, and that's what I've tried to design into the frog.
On the Golf Smarter podcast that we do, there's a segment called Ask Kenny, where listeners send in emails to get Kenny's opinion on different aspects of products. I don't think that Judson Smith of New Orleans, Louisiana, would ever think that when he sent in this question, he would go right to the source. And so, Scotty, I want to read this note to you and see what your answer would be.
Okay.
Judson says that about 2 years ago, his grandfather gave him his clubs because the doctor said he couldn't play anymore. The putter in that set of clubs is the Scotty Cameron Newport that he'd say he thinks is about 8 to 10 years old. He likes the putter, and he putts reasonably well with it. But on the other hand, he really likes the way the larger head putter, like the Odyssey White 2 ball, feels when he hits the ball. So he'd like to know, is the Newport going to give him anything that a putter like the 2 ball would not?
Well, where the Odyssey is a mallet and more a larger size, it's very possible that his grandfather, who left him the actual Scotty Cameron putter, was more of a fan of the heel and toe weighted simple effect, where other, it seems like a lot of the younger golfers coming up are more into the larger, bigger size. And that's why in the Titleist line we do mallets, we do blades, and we do in between, because it is so personal from the look, the sound, and the feel. So it all depends on what you want. Not your grandfather, but what you want. And if it works, stick with it. And if it doesn't, look for something new.
That's a fair answer. Thank you.
Sure. I'm a big believer in that. If it works, stick with it.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, understand why it's not working and fix the problem.
That's a critical element, I think, is understanding why it's not working for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Scotty, what do you feel is your single greatest contribution to the game?
Wow. Well, I think...
I know you're not done.
No. But, gosh, I'm just getting warmed up,
I think. Exactly, exactly. But to this point...
You know, I'm intrigued, just like your viewers, your listeners, I'm intrigued with this, and I have the same questions as they have. For example, the performance of a golf ball is such a mystery to most. And as Frank and I touched on it, there are facts. And I've always wanted to speak from the facts. And I've always wanted to give kudos to certain designs. I think Carson Solheim was a genius. So learning the facts. I have questions, but thank you, Titleist, for the putter studio and funding my harebrained ideas and then proving the facts to these players that come into the studio. I am so intrigued, and I think we're just slowly getting better, and milling and manufacturing and feels and sounds. What have I brought? I think, I don't know what I've brought, but I still want to bring it.
Frank, what about you? What do you think is your single greatest contribution to golf?
You know, as Scotty was sort of confused by the question, not confused, but...
humility aside, come on.
I'm relatively similar. I think I would like to say that my concern is the golfer. My concern is the game, and I think that I've tried to contribute to that through my time with the USGA. The introduction of the graphite shaft was okay. I mean, that was an invention that I got $1 for, but at the same time, I think it has been a good contribution. I think being able to quantify the speed of greens was another thing through the stimp meter. I do believe that the time I had spent with the USGA has contributed fairly significantly to the game. I was there for a quarter of the existence of the USGA, and I think that right now my objective is to try and help golfers, to try and make sure that any innovations that are introduced are generally in the best interest of the game and are helping. I think that marketing is unfortunately having a significant influence on the game right now, and unfortunately the implications are that these wonderful clubs are going to do all sorts of wonderful things for you. And in fact, they will do something good for you, but it's not half as large as the implication and the inference on the part of the golfer. So I think it's for us to make sure that the manufacturers regain credibility, and I think in doing so, they produce good stuff and don't overpromise, but recognize that there is a marketing problem here, and you need to push it to the envelope. But my objective is to try and inform golfers as much as possible, and I think the mission of Frankly Golf is to help golfers, and I hope I'm doing that.
I think
hey,
we would all...
That's pretty good.
Frank, you did, am I correct with this, you did invent the stimp meter, correct?
No, I didn't invent it. I the stimp meter is actually designed in 1935, and the green section of the USGA asked me to come up with a method of measuring the green speeds, and I designed two different, as a matter of fact, three different concepts of being able to do it. Very intricate, very accurate, but they were also operator dependent. And then I looked back at a concept that Eddie Stimson had designed in 1935, and I said, wait a minute, I'd rejected that because it was inconsistent, and I redesigned it. I redesigned it in 1977, and checked it out. We had made five of them out of wood, and I asked our green section to measure greens, standard greens that they were working on, and they did measure greens in 35 states, and we came up with an average green speed of about 6'6" for everyday play. Agronomy has changed significantly since then, and they've been able to get greens extremely fast, unfortunately sometimes too fast for the undulations, but at the same time, agronomy has changed in the rest of the golf course, and in 1998 at the Olympic Club during the U.S. Open, I measured the fairway speeds, and they were 6'6". So you can see how agronomy has changed. No, I think the introduction of the stimp meter was to try and quantify the speed of greens. P.J. Boatwright, who was the executive director of the USGA in 1976, we were sitting the whole locations at the U.S. Open, and he said to me, he said, Thomas, he says, these greens are faster than they were last year. I said, well, how fast were they last year, PJ? He says, slower than this year. So I knew immediately we had a problem. I said, PJ, if you ever die, we're not going to be able to tell the speed of greens. So we had to do that. And I think that's an innovation that has helped us, now being used all around the world.
Very good. I have one question for Scotty real quick, because we get the question a lot, and it's small, but the significance of the number 62 on the Circa series, does that relate to your birth year?
It does, but the era back then in 62 was, you know, from Carson Solheim and Mr. T.P. Mills that has passed on, I believe, last year. There were some great, and I think as you asked the last question about what have I brought or what do I, is the craftsmanship. And these guys, T.P. made some fantastic putters, but from 1962, he made some great stuff. Carson made some great stuff. And I think if I'm to carry that torch, and great design, great craftsmanship, great quality is what I would like to be known for the most.
Now, that's a contribution.
What's that?
I said that's a contribution.
Well, thank you. But Circa 62 is when I was born in 62. But again, during that time, there were some great putter designs and some classic shapes. And John Reuter or Reuter, the bullseye, of that era, there are some great things. So that's what I really meant about Circa 62.
Okay. Well, that clarifies it for me. I can answer it correctly now.
Sure.
Maybe, Scotty, we should join teams, join forces here.
Well, I like the way you're talking. I think, you know, you've done some homework, but every day the high-speed video and all that, again, I'm just like you guys. I want to know more. I want to stand over a putt and understand what is happening, not what if or why. I want to know the facts. And, again, thank you, Titleist, for giving me the tools to be able to learn more so I can share it and put it into my products.
You know, Scotty, if you guys do join up, I'd advise you don't let Frank do the negotiation, because if he only got a dollar for that graphite shaft.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Oh, man.
But those are the little things that I really enjoy, are those like the stamp meter, where did the name come from? That kind of history for people to know in today is fascinating to me.
This was a phenomenal conversation, gentlemen. I really appreciate your time. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did, and I know that the audience is feeling the same way.
Yeah, thank you guys very much.
It was my pleasure to be with you, and nice to speak with you too, Scotty.
Frank, we'll see you down the road.
Absolutely.
And you guys, thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it very much.
Our pleasure.
A pleasure and an honor. Now, how would you like to have a brand new putter? Go to golfbetterpodcast.com and sign up to win either a Scotty Cameron or Frankly Frog putter courtesy of Edwin Watts Golf. Deadline for entries is Sunday, July 8th, 2007. Coming up on our next episode of Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf, we'll learn more about hybrid clubs. Thanks for listening, and we invite you to listen to our sister podcast, Golf Smarter. We publish Golf Smarter every week and cover a wide range of topics that focus on strategy, course management, mental and physical conditioning. And based on emails and iTunes reviews, this information lowers scores. Easily found at iTunes or at golfsmarterpodcast.com. Plus, each episode, Kenny Nicholson, who joined us on today's conversation, answers listeners' questions on how to become smarter golf consumers. And did I mention that every episode, he also gives away fabulous golf gear? If you're so inclined, please write a review for the Golf Better at Edwin Watts Golf podcast on iTunes. And if you have any questions or comments you'd like to direct to us, send an email to golfbetter@edwinwattsgolf.com.